Yeah, I guess it is. I was looking for a light. Oh, there. Okay. It's a slight technical difficulty. So I am going to talk officially. This is an official MCLE talk, and it's about elimination of bias. But that's easy because there's plenty to talk about that also has to do with mindfulness meditation. And it certainly also fits into our theme about difficulties having to do with confrontation and conflict. I think the major reason that we have so much difficulty with conflict and with confrontation, we get caught, is our habit of forgetting the fact of interconnection, the fact that we really are not separate. We think of ourselves as separate, standalone beings, which is not true, but we forget. We have a habit of mind, a habit of picking and choosing. I like this, I don't like that, I'm better than so-and-so, la-di-da is better than I like, I don't like. We judge, and we have a habit of separating from one another, forgetting connection, separating from our experience, and making other, making someone other, making some experience other, making it not me. Those are our habits. And when we meditate, we begin to see our habits. So the subtitle of this talk is, what's meditation got to do with it? And there's a kind of a summary of it in the materials you'll get, but I'll tell you right now that whatever I say is going to be very different from what's in there. That we have a habit, it's almost hardwired in us, a habit of discrimination. And it's not necessarily bad discrimination in the sense that I just used it. I think James used the word discernment. There's a certain kind of wisdom we need to operate in the world, a certain kind of discernment. I need to know that I am separate from that bell in order to not walk into it and stub my toe, right? In some sense, I am not separate from that bell. But in this sort of everyday sense, I am, and I have to remember that. So I have to discriminate between myself and the bell. I have to discriminate between myself and each of you, even though, in fact, we're completely connected. So there's a kind of discrimination that we need, that there's a kind of discrimination that we add on, and that's a problem. Sometimes we say we believe too much in our discriminations, and that's a problem. And we have a habit of doing that. We have a habit of forgetting interconnection. We remember discrimination. We don't even remember it. We just do it mindlessly. So elimination of bias, elimination of judging and separating and making other is important. And the State Bar thinks it's important enough to require 1 hour each year in continuing education credit in elimination of bias. And there's a rule of professional conduct that prohibits it and actually requires that we report it if we see it in the legal system. particularly in firms. But it's just plain old important. It's important to not be biased, to not discriminate. When we do discriminate, we cost ourselves connection. When I say discriminate, I mean in the sense of judging and separating ourselves. We cost ourselves a deep connection. It's painful, I think, it is painful, I know, on some level. There's even a word for it. Sometimes dissatisfaction, sometimes dis-ease, sometimes suffering. This is, seems to me, self-evident truth. It's also basic Buddhism. So when we separate ourselves and when we make others other, I mean other sort of in quotes as not me, there's a real cost, a heart level cost. And there's also a plain old practical level cost in the world. I'm focusing mostly on racial discrimination, but any kind counts. Sexual discrimination, gender, ability, you name it. There was an article that I read in the paper not long ago about how juries operated, and it was really interesting. It said that somebody did a test, a sociological study or something with juries, and they found that all white juries didn't really think very hard. They didn't look very well. If one of the members raised an issue about race, the others tended to just dismiss it. They did not want to look at it. And sometimes they raised schmace, they just didn't look at the evidence all that carefully. They didn't come, I would say, this is not what they said, but the article said, but I would say it's like they did not come with their best minds, with their best selves. And when the juries were racially mixed, they did a much better job. If someone raised an issue of race, they actually examined it. But also, they examined the facts. Just whatever they might be, how far away was the other driver or something. They really were much better at examining the facts. They didn't use this phrase, but what came to me was they were on their best behavior. Whatever works. I thought that was really, really interesting, that when there is such homogeneity, there's a way in which we can go on automatic pilot. And, for the plaintiff, for the defendant, that might be extremely costly. And for the system as a whole, for the integrity of the system, and for the participants, it seems to me, it's costly when we go on automatic pilot. And isn't that what meditation is about? Isn't that what mindfulness is about? James spoke of seeing clearly. Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, used to talk about seeing things as it is. Things as it is, which emphasizes both sides, right? Things, because there are myriad things, but as it is, because there's only one thing, we're not separate. But we want to see clearly. We want to see things clearly. And when we go on automatic pilot, of course, we don't. We don't see. That's the time when you're just off somewhere on a train of thought. or sometimes half asleep. So when we meditate, we form the habit of returning ourselves to the present. We deepen that habit. We deepen that groove. Right? We have the habit of not seeing. We have the habit of being on automatic pilot and just going with our usual assumptions of separateness. And when we meditate, we're forming a wholesome habit of paying attention, of coming back to the present, and being willing to sit still right in the middle of it. James, I talked about, I don't know if he used the word investigation, but he was talking about noticing and saying, oh, that's what's right in front. Oh, that's what's here. Oh, that's interesting. What's that? Being willing to be present for it and not turn away from reality, even if it's difficult. And I think the first step in dealing with bias is seeing it and admitting our own biases. It's not always easy to see. It's particularly difficult for white people to see. We think, not consciously, but we think that race has to do with people of color, those other people. Maybe some ethnicity or something. But we don't think of it as having there as a white even as being a race. White is base. White is, I don't know, neutral. And we have particularly, white men have a sense of entitlement. Perhaps all of us have various senses of entitlement about various things, I don't know, I imagine. But at any rate, there's a sense of entitlement which is not visible to us. I mean, white people have a sense of entitlement. One of the classic things, when I see a highway patrolman on the freeway, I'll probably slow down, but I don't think that I'm going to get stopped if I'm doing 70 miles an hour. But particularly a young black man better slow down to 65 and sees that highway patrolman and does not think, oh, they're the knights of the road, the protectors of us all. It's a different assumption and not an unreasonable one. You know, now that's becoming known, right? They say there's this crime, it's called driving while black. And even the president acknowledges it, so hey. But that operates in lots and lots of ways. And since we have this sense of entitlement or that we're the neutral or the base, we don't notice it. We have to develop the habit of paying attention so as to notice it. There's a wonderful, interesting article with your materials, which is called White Lawyering, by a man named Russell Pierce. He's a professor, a law professor. And he talks about this invisibility of the issue for white people, the sense of authority. And he has various examples. He talks particularly about how that operates for white men. And one of his examples is in his classes, he lets the students call him by his first name. And he talked to some of his colleagues about that. And the women and or the people of color said they did not allow that. And his sense was that that had to do with the different authority roles. Or these people's, his colleagues need to, I don't know how I want to say it, be more visible or feel that they had to maintain that authority in the classroom more, that they didn't feel free to do that. I'm not sure that's a good example. That could be a very personal event. This wasn't a study. This was a few conversations. But it resonates with me from my experience as a woman lawyer. He also, and I'll come back to that, he talked about young lawyers and law students, I guess in a, like a clinic program, and they would all put on their suits and go to court with him. And the white lawyers and law students would be treated as lawyers and law students, or as lawyers, I guess, whatever. The people of color, it was not at all uncommon for them to be seen as secretaries or messengers or clients by opposing counsel and judges and court personnel and so on. Sometimes I think they probably were kind of semi-visible. He just made a distinction between people of color and white, and I don't know what women's experience is these days. When I started being a lawyer in 1971, and I stopped in 1989, and it was my experience that I was sometimes invisible. I got taken for the court reporter more than once. And I was in a suit and I had a briefcase in my hand. One time I worked for a small personal injury trial firm, and the two partners and I were the three lawyers, and they were both male, and we went to lunch, and I came back a little earlier because I had a deposition that day. And in that office, it was kind of an open plan. You came in and there was a receptionist, a woman, a secretary, a woman, me, a woman, another secretary, a woman, and then it opened out into one bigger office, and that's where the two partners had their desks, and but they weren't there. And the man who was coming to representing the defendant came in, and he got off the elevator, and he walked by the receptionist, by the secretary, by me, by the other secretary, craning his head and looking around and saying, "Is anybody here?" You know, and it's sort of funny, but it's also kind of not. Luckily, the deposition went well. But, in my view. But that's an example of being invisible. I don't know if this still happens. I'll give you one more example and then I'll stop, because of course I could go on forever. In that same firm, my experience was that I would start a case and file a complaint and serve it, and then the other side would get a lawyer, and the lawyer would call me, and they would call me by my first name. People that I had never seen before in my life, or nor talked to or anything. I didn't and don't like that. I'm old-fashioned about that. I like to be called by my last name, at least for a while. And I talked about it to the senior partner, and I told him my experience, and he said, "Yeah, I don't like that either." And he said, "What I do is, I just keep calling them by their last name. And then pretty soon they notice a dissonance and they start calling me by my last name." And I thought, you know what? That won't work for me, because they would not feel a dissonance. I'm the girl. So I had to figure out something else, and it, you know, either sort of sound sort of priggish or just call them by their first name or whatever. There weren't any real attractive alternatives. So I imagine, I hope this is better. I imagine it's better, but it's not easy. And coming back to the jury study, it's just that we don't want to look at our bias. It's painful. We don't see it. So when the juries were all white and somebody would raise a question, that person would just get marginalized, dismissed. They'd say, no, why are you playing the race card? That kind of thing. We don't want to look. And I don't see myself as terribly... I can go on automatic pilot too. I mean, I do want to look. I very much want to look. I want to see this. I want to see my own racism and my own sexism and so on. I know there's a theory, and it's probably right. I don't want to make too much of a distinction here, but you know, sometimes we say we're all racist, we're all sexist, we're all homophobic and so on. And there's an understanding which makes sense that the recipients of that, or the victims, if you like, are not, like, women are not sexist. We instead have internalized that oppression. Or people of color are not racists. But I don't want to, you know, if I make all the distinctions that one could make, this takes too long today. So I say that I want to see my sexism. But I'm also quite capable of going on automatic pilot. I'm capable of being insensitive. But my meditation practice, my practice of being present, what do I want to say? It develops my habit. It nurtures my habit. It deepens that. If you think of a habit as a groove, those of you old enough to remember, you know what a record looks like? Records have grooves, you know. So the needle goes into a groove. Well, it deepens that groove. The meditation deepens that habit groove of paying attention. And isn't that exactly the process of meditation? It's coming back to the present, coming back and coming back and coming back. And being with what is right now, with my breath, with my knee that hurts, with my back that hurts, with some intense emotion that comes up, with whatever is right now in this body and mind, my intention is to keep coming back to it. And that's the process of waking up. And then we take our meditation process out into the world. In other words, that meditation doesn't stop when you get up from your cushion or your chair or whatever. That intention to pay attention, which is mindfulness, that continues. That intention to pay attention to the breath continues. If you know where your breath is all the time, which is my intention, at which I fail, but it is my intention, it can tell you a lot. Okay? So if you're uncomfortable and your breath is in your chest, or you're paying attention to your body and you're uncomfortable and your jaw is clenched, probably a good time to kind of stop for a moment and ask yourself, what's going on here? Give it some breath. But we work with meditation in order to learn how to pay attention to these things, to notice them. So we sit on the cushion and then we continue it out in the world. So that paying attention and acknowledging things as it is. So I have to acknowledge my sexism, my racism, my homophobia, and so on. Because that's got to be the place to start. I start with what is. And I am a product of this culture, after all. I grew up here. I'm a white person in this culture. and it's not easy to see. Charlie Gary, whom many of you have heard of, I guess, I don't know, he was a criminal defense lawyer in the 60s and 70s. He represented a lot of Black Panthers, including Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. And he used to talk, when he chose juries, he would talk about overt racism and covert racism. Because most of us are not overt racists, which is nice, much nicer than being Klan people or something, but we're covert racists. And that's more pleasant, but it's also it's harder to see. So we need to be paying attention to our own racism so we can see it. Because you can't deal with it if you don't see it. Every so often something happens and then it's in your face and it's really hard and difficult and painful, but then you can see it. Then you can see it. I used to live at the San Francisco Zen Center, and it was in a kind of rough part of town. It's getting gentrified. It's not so rough anymore, but it was. And one night I was going somewhere, I don't know, and it was maybe around 10 o'clock at night, and I went to, and I got in my car, and just as I started to turn the key, a relatively young, tall, Black man approached me, and he was coming towards my door. And I turned the key and I drove away. And as I drove away, I saw his face, and I noticed that he was actually dressed nicely, to the extent that matters. At his face, the look of pain and disgust was really intense. And my feeling of shame was really intense. I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop, and I am so sorry. I mean, he probably just wanted directions or something. I have no idea what he wanted. I wish I thought that was an isolated event for him, but it probably wasn't. I probably reinforced for him, yet again, the racism in our culture. I've heard Black men, African American men are often, they're used to crossing a street and hearing the sound of the doors locking in a car. I don't know if you've ever done that, but it doesn't pass unnoticed. So, you know, I don't know who he was. I know nothing about him. I can't go make amends directly to him. This is the first time I ever talked about it publicly. And what I can do is remember. You know, not obsess about it. That's not useful. But it is kind of emblematic to remember to pay attention, to remember to do my practice, to notice if I'm frightened, to notice whatever and set it aside and just come back and remember connection. Remember connection. So I use it to deepen my intention. And I tell you this story in the faith that I'm not the only one that ever did such a thing here. See, I'm not the only one here that ever did such a thing. So this meditative process this process of keeping coming back, keeping, you know, there's a way, which I said this morning, you know, let the thoughts be like bubbles, but you also, you can't help but notice them. You notice your habits, right? If you continually have thoughts of lust, then after a while you begin to notice, oh, I have that habit, or I have a habit of greed, or my habitual, my default mode is anger or jealousy or whatever it might be. You can't help but notice the patterns. And you see your habit of judging. You see the habit of picking and choosing. I like, I don't like. The habit of James mentioned, you know, the kind of thoughts that are really attractive. Like, oh, I think I'll go with that one. Or there's also a different way you can get entangled that way. You can also get entangled with the kind that you hate. Either obsessive thoughts of rehashing an old argument or an old hurt, or something really yucky to you, you get entangled with it. What was that? Like, don't think of a pink elephant. It becomes this pink elephant. Okay, so we get tangled, and then we let them go. But we see, as we meditate, if we do it regularly, you begin to see this mind that judges and that picks and chooses and that separates and that makes other, that forgets connection. Sometimes people begin meditating and they come to think, I had no idea. I've become a terrible, really terrible person. I judge and I'm jealous and I'm angry a lot and I hate people. Oh, this is, I don't know what's happened to me. I didn't used to be a person like that. Well, you were. I have a friend that says it ought to come with a warning label. Because what's happened is you just got quiet enough, slowed down enough to see your mind. You're just, this is both good news and bad news, maybe. You're just another human being. That's all. That's all. But we get quiet enough and we begin to see this mind. And that's where it has to start, right? It has to start with seeing it. How can you let go of your bias, let go of your habit of separating, if you don't see it? I don't want to spend time on this, I mean, because the theme is about conflict. It's much easier to disrespect somebody, to go ballistic on them, to go off on them, or to retreat and abdicate. It's much easier if you have made them other, if you have forgotten that they're not another, they're just another human being like you, which will, I'm sure, get talked about substantially here, but I just wanted to make that connection too. So you don't become a terrible person when you start to meditate. You just become a person. And as you see it, you stop taking it quite so seriously. You don't buy into it quite so much. And you can let it go. Just as you come back to your breath, let go of your thoughts. Come back to your breath, let go of your thoughts. Come back to your body, let go of your thoughts. That process of letting go and just sitting down in the middle of the flow of what is. It has a ripple effect in the rest of our lives. So we can let go of our habits, our habit of separating, our habit of making other. We can see connection more. There can be a lightness that grows. And then it becomes easier to own our stuff, our shadow side, because it no longer, I don't know, it's like it no longer confirms that you're an evil person. It's just that one of your unwholesome habits surfaced, maybe had an effect out in the world. So you can say, oh, I see. And then come back to your breath. Make amends if you need to. And you also work on the habit in meditation of letting go of that self-criticism reflex. I love that image of piling it on, which is what we do. You know, you notice you're thinking and you criticize yourself, and then you notice that you're criticizing yourself, and then you criticize yourself for criticizing yourself. And you can, if you want, you can go on for many, many layers. It's got, when you were doing that, James, I was thinking, you get so heavy. It's quite burdensome what we do to ourselves. So in meditation, you can begin to let go of that. You can at least stop criticizing yourself for criticizing yourself. You know, at least that layer you could let go of. You may or may not stop criticizing yourself, but you don't have to take it quite so seriously. And then you can actually see your mistakes and own them, and they don't become so heavy. Because if they're that heavy, you can't own them. Do you understand what I'm saying? That sometimes for some people, you can't own a mistake because it confirms some belief that you're really an evil person. So then, no mistakes. So, I'm saying two things to you. Let us deepen our intention to see our biases. Let us work on developing that habit of paying attention. Develop our intention to pay attention. But at the same time, I'm saying, lighten up. Can we do this with gentleness and kindness? With that spirit of investigation of what is this? What's going on here? I'm just being a human being. But maybe there's something for me to learn here. There's a phrase, I don't know if I have wrote it down here. I think there's a phrase that that Pierce uses in the article. I think it's like investigation and learning. I thought, well, that's a good phrase for one aspect of meditation. Investigating, that there be a question. So important that it be a question. What's going on here? So please let us remember. Thanks. So do you have questions or comments? We have about 15 minutes.
I'm intrigued by the way conference calls trump and don't trump some of this. I do a lot of transactions where I never see parties. And trying to figure out who they are and how to talk to them and without seeing them. Really, I guess, looking for biases, for my own biases to who they are, and then watching how the dynamic works without people being present. Trying to think about that in the context of your lesson here to think about the basic programming, because it gets disrupted a little bit in that environment.
Well, that's right, and that's really interesting. And even so, as if I understand you right, you talking on a conference call, and you still have ideas about who people are, but if you're noticing that, and then
people play, there'll be questions about who's playing golf and how are your kids and what school did you go to? And you can see as people are maneuvering to try to get context. See what it tells them in terms of how they can move ahead.
We have comfort zones.
I mean, there are different. The other part of that, too, is that, and it's inherent in the, and it's different than the litigation thing, because in a transaction, if it doesn't close, everybody loses.
Mm-hmm.
which is different than the classic I win, you lose litigation mode. So there's a part of that that's a search for connection, at the same time an awareness of bias. It's intriguing.
Right. Well, one thing I want to leave you with is that there be a question, you know, as long as there's a question, I think we're in good shape. You know, what's going on? Because connection and, you know, asking how the kids are seems fine to me. Anything else? Uh-huh.
I wanted to bring up something that I've been thinking about recently, especially last Friday, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was in San Francisco for a conference with Muslim leaders from around the country, a multi-faith conference about the heart of compassion. And I think one area that you didn't mention, which has been so painful for so many in this country, are people of Arab descent or Muslim people, women that wear headdress or men that wear headdress, people that are Sikh who are confused with other. I mean, there's, since 9/11, it's just been a nightmare.
Yeah, that I mentioned ethnic, but I didn't. That, and that's exactly what I was thinking of. But it has been, and there's a way in which they're not invisible. They're very visible, but as human beings, they're not visible. And it is a big problem here. Mercedes?
Hold on, Mercedes.
Okay. Well, I was listening to you. I was thinking about my practice has lately developed into a lot of contested divorces. And it has been very painful to really go through this particular field. And I develop some sort of bias against a lot of attorneys, male attorneys, Jewish attorneys, Italian attorneys. And I'm like, I'm going to hate the whole world. And the question is, when they see me coming in, oh, are you legal aid? And I go, I wish. So I get paid by the hour. If I do, well, I get a salary or benefits.
Yeah.
And I was listening to you, and it's so true. You know, I already, when I come in for the preliminary conferences or whatever we have in New York, I come in with so much trepidation. You know, I got to pump myself in when I come in to get into that fighting box, you know. And it's costing me a lot, to the point that I'm saying, you know, I'd rather fight the government. I'd rather just do immigration. And I feel better when I fight the government. At least I'm not fighting one particular lawyer. It's the government. So I'm dealing with that. And I just don't know. It's that bias about other attorneys. I'm always feeling like they're up to being just very harsh.
Well, you're very gentle, actually. I mean, we don't have time to go to talk about it a lot, but there's lots of kinds of bias, and I'm sort of trying to get you an hour of credit, but one way that I've dealt with it in negotiations, in union negotiations, representing a union against management, where the lawyer on the other side was particularly difficult, was to remind myself that this person does not want to suffer, and to remind myself about the distinction between being fierce and being angry. You know, because sometimes you do need to be fierce, but you don't need to be angry. You don't need to have that feeling of going to war or whatever. But I'm not saying that it's easy. It's not easy. But if people like you who have this question about, you know, how, what kind of a person do I want to be in litigation? If people like you don't do it, how's it ever going to change? Because you have the question, and a lot of people don't have the question. They just suffer, and they think that's how they have to be. That's how it's done. You should talk to Edith about doing family law in a way that's not where it's very hard, and the clients get crazy, and it's hard not to buy into that. Or they want you to be a junkyard dog, and then what do you do? Seeing it. I use the word confession a lot, and it's kind of a big word, but seeing it is first. You can't let it go if you don't see it. So welcome to the club.
I just had more of a comment, though. If you have any suggestions, that would be greatly appreciated. One of the things I notice with my clients, I do not very many, but occasionally I'll do a personal injury case, and I have one right now that's a difficult one because it's a lead contamination case, and the couple who I'm dealing with is a sort of very politically correct, very educated, young, probably in their mid-30s, couple, and then their daughter, their very young daughter, had a spike in her lead levels, and that's what's caused it. And so what I've seen happen is these people who sort of live a very pro-environmental, awake life in a lot of other ways, I've heard them lapse into what I consider to be really, bigoted. I personally hate the phrase white trash, because I feel like first of all, we're distinguishing, like, we have to say white trash, like, oh, well, if you're white, like, you have to make that distinction. So I think it's racist in that way against if you're not white. And then if you're white, I mean, just calling a person trash to me has a lot of very powerful and damaging effects. But so I see these people that are really lovely people in some ways, and they get so filled with anger. And then it's like, you know, this guy who worked in our house, he's so white trash, and he's this and he's that. And I, you know, my response has been to let them vent. And then usually I'll say to them at some point, you know, if I get in bed with you and your anger against these people, you know, I'm not going to be able to help you with your case, and you have to trust that. But what I really see is them wanting, and they've basically said this, is them wanting to pull myself and my one of my other partners into this anger, and feeling that if we're not in this anger with them, then their attorneys are rolling over, when I actually feel that the people in the case have been quite reasonable. So I don't know if you have any thoughts. I have tried to approach it every way, including, you know, have some perspective on this. You know, your daughter's going to be okay, and I know it's really hard. But so I don't know if you have any thoughts, but I just thought I would share that.
Thanks. Yes. It's a very common problem. It's especially common in domestic relations cases or in probate if there's a will contest. People want the lawyer to buy into their feeling, and they want you to be their junkyard dog and punish. They want you to punish the other side. And that's very, very common in lots of different things. And so at least know that you have a lot of company. And it's easy to get sucked into that. And you're right, it's not useful to the client or anybody. And it sounds like you're handling it well. I don't know if you've done this, but one thing that we've worked with in some work we've done in other retreats is active listening. So at least one time, just sit down with them and completely let them vent as much as they want, and repeat back as simply as you can what it is you're hearing. And each time when you've repeated back, then you say, "Did I get it all?" Until they say yes, and then they can go on to the next whatever. Let them feel completely heard at least once. Just let them, let it rip however they may say it. And then I don't know. Anyway, it's part of our job in some way. We, you know, it's training in law school to not get too identified. And in some ways, most of us don't like that so much. But there are ways in which it's useful. That not get, you know, you're supposed to be able to argue any side of anything. Well, I don't think so. But there's a way in which that's a useful value. To not get so identified with your client's case that you're actually not a very good representative. So that is true. But it's difficult. It's difficult. I don't want any answers or any show of hands or anything, but I want you to ask yourselves, when she started talking about her clients, what color did you picture them to be? If you did. And then when she said that they called people white trash, did your picture of them change? Just notice that. Now, maybe you didn't have an assumption about it, but the default assumption in this culture is white. And then the criticism, white trash, then maybe they were African American or people of color. But you know what? We don't know either one. We don't know. She didn't say. But just, that's like, watch your mind. Watch your mind. One, two, and then I think we need to stop.
So I want to recognize that.
I think you need to use the mic because I have a feeling that may be recording or something.
Oh, too bad.
Well, somebody would probably like to listen to this.
Yeah, just like a rock star.
Yes.
So I want to recognize that I'm, you know, trying to engage and really think in terms of race, class, and gender in analyzing my own bias. But when you were talking about thinking about others' otherness and creating a separate category, this is something that I've really been struggling with because I consider myself to be a cause lawyer, and I go back and forth in this habit of dehumanizing defense counsel who are probably don't think of themselves as, you know, defense cause lawyers in this in my field. I don't imagine anyone, you know, goes to law school saying, yes, I'm going to fight for the right, in my case, fight for the right of polluters. But I do find myself dehumanizing and saying things like, how can they sleep at night? And I don't know whether that is a bias that I even want to address in the category of bias or whether it's, you know, a useful way for me to move forward in my own, you know, professional career with my goals. So I just wondered whether you had any thoughts on creating otherness based on people's professional choices.
Yeah, don't do it. It's hard. I think that's what you're going to talk about to some tonight. Is that true, or am I, Richard? I'm looking. Okay. Well, anyway, it's very hard. I don't know about you. I create otherness with the National Administration a lot. You know? And it's not useful. It's not useful. We can still fight the good fight without doing that. Those of us who have left politics think somehow we in our bones that we can't. It's like you might soften, and you wouldn't really still fight the good fight, and you wouldn't da da da. I don't think that's true. But we don't have to do it as a war. Lainey, I think we need to, I don't know where Doug is. What time do we have to stop? I think.
On your sheet.
That isn't, oh, here it is. This is one that's vague. It says an hour and a quarter. So let's let you be the last question. But Lainey is the next question. This woman right here.
I have two comments. One is, I think it's really important to understand that the profession itself is structurally designed, in my opinion, to separate people and not to foster the kind of relationships. And to the extent, you know, I don't know anything about her case, but to the extent there's anything you can do to take your issues outside the system. I mean, I've had situations if, you know, you just get people in a room together without the court reporter, without people on the other side of the table, try to get a round table, you know, try to just let clients have relationships with the clients on the other side and realize that the whole structure of the system is designed to impose separation. You know, there's defendants, there's plaintiffs. You can't ask a question without sending an interrogatory. You can't go anyplace without requesting a site visit. You know, and to the extent you can be creative in anything you do to get outside that system to work on actual relationships, I have found it just totally changes the whole thing. And then the other comment was, to the extent people have relationships or can have relationships with people with disabilities really goes directly to so many of the issues that you're talking about, because there's all this fear in seeing people with disabilities in terms of, well, they better be other because I don't want to be like that.
Yeah.
And I might be like that. And to get yourself to, you know, see a blind person without the cane or see the wheelchair rider without the wheelchair. And, you know, I've been representing, doing this work for 15 years, and it still hits me like, whoa, you know, I'm getting the human connection instead of the definition of the person as a disabled person, someone who uses a wheelchair. So if you have any opportunity to have any relationships with people with disabilities, it really sort of forces that issue right on you.
Yeah. Thank you. You need to get the mic.
As somewhat a novice at this, in doing criminal defense work, in which you were in a very adversarial situation where often you find yourselves diametrically opposed in terms of what you believe may be the appropriate resolution versus what the other side may believe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite clear how you bring in this meditative process into that function when you tend to get fierce without losing that center.
Well, you just keep working on staying in your seat and at the same time not seeing the DA or the, you know, cop witnesses or whoever as inhuman. What we do is we make them inhuman, and we don't need to do that. I have a friend who's a criminal defense lawyer, and often her effort is to find the humanity in the district attorney and in the judge so that then they can see the humanity of her client. Do you think that's inaccurate? And she's been a public defender in San Francisco for a really long time, so I don't mean to be glib and say it's easy. It's not easy. But I think the place to start is realizing that we do, you know, it's an adversarial system, right? That's what we call it. And we make other. And then we fight them. So if we can remember that they're not other. You know, the basic beginning of loving kindness meditation is, I wish myself well. May I be well, happy, at ease. May I be free from suffering. And as we find out how deeply we want to be free of suffering and how deeply that touches us, the point of that is to remember that that applies to everybody. You know, we all think we're so separate. I think I'm the only one who's insecure. I think I'm the only one that feels left out in a group. I think I'm the only one. Da, da, da. That's not true. We all have those feelings, and none of us wants to suffer. So if we can see that about somebody, then we can begin to see them as a human being. And that still, you can still set limits. You can still say no. You can still say we're going to have to take this to trial. But you don't have to hate on them. Because it costs you a lot. It hurts. But it's not easy. So I just got the sign to stop from the boss. He just went. Anyway, so thank you very much. And please remember, take a kindly, friendly interest. Okay? Thanks. Where are we? Okay, now we have walking meditation.
Let's do this.
Let's do what?
I'll just say.
Go ahead. Do you want this?
Okay, so we're going to have walking now. There's some people who arrived late today, and if you would like to stick around for a little bit, and James and I could do a short orientation to this program and to meditation, we can do that here. Is that good? And everyone else, please.
20 minutes.
Yeah, but we'll ring the bell about 20, 25 minutes.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.